Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. Last month, we discussed trends in cardiac surgery and how AI data is driving the minimally invasive procedure revolution. This month, we discuss the future of heart rhythm care. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay. We go back to the electrophysiology lab to check in with Deborah cardiologist Dr. Raffaele Corbizero on the future of heart rhythm care. To be sure, he and his team perform procedures that, while no longer unimaginable, are pretty wild to contemplate. Threading catheters through your body to actually enter your heart and gather information, zap a patch of tissue, or even deliver a device. That all seems futuristic enough to us mere mortals, but there are even more amazing advances in the works to make these treatments safer and even more effective and durable. We start with a quick review of arrhythmias.
So the baseline definition of an arrhythmia is anything out of the normal sequence in a heart rhythm. So it can range from a skip beat all the way to a completely abnormal, disorganized rhythm.
Which arrhythmia is the one that concerns you the most?
To follow the sequence of the heart, especially from a rhythm standpoint, it's a sequential beat top to bottom. What we worry about the most is the bottom. Abnormal rhythms in the bottom part of the heart can be life-threatening and need to be treated aggressively and prophylactically if possible.
So what are the recent advances in heart rhythm management?
So the most common rhythm is in the top part of the heart, the atria. The rhythm is called atrial fibrillation. And the most recent advance has been in the type of ablation that's done. It was discovered over 20 years ago that the origin of AFib comes from specific veins that plug into the heart. And it was theorized that if we could prevent those abnormal signals from escaping the veins with a procedure called an ablation, as opposed to suppressing them with drugs, that we would have a better outcome with the AFib. And it turns out that they were correct. So now the frontline therapy is ablation. And for years we've been trying to perfect ablation for atrial fibrillation, but the newest modality is called pulse field ablation, which has taken hold and is being evaluated. Ablation is a procedure. It is not surgery.
And you're not getting zapped from the outside.
Correct. The ablation procedure is akin to cardiac catheterization. Usually access is from the leg vein, where we go up the vein and into the heart. For the atrial fibrillation ablation, we cross over the top septum to get to the top left part of the heart, where 95% of the AFib comes from. The catheter that's introduced is able to deliver energy. The energy is basically creating, if you will, an electrical fence around the areas where the AFib comes from and prevents its initiation.
Is it like scar tissue then around it?
Sort of, yeah. Basically, from an electrical standpoint, what the energy does is dries out the cells, does not allow a cell to conduct an electrical signal. So if that fence is created and the AFib signal cannot cross it, it cannot get out to throw the whole atrium into atrial fibrillation.
About how big are these catheters?
Usually it's they're like 6 French catheters. So what is that? A couple of millimeters?
So it's more than, say, fishing line.
Oh, yes. Yes. They're catheters that you can, basically, I would say it's like a piece of linguine. So the heart, in terms of the way it's built, there is a right side and a left side. Arrhythmias can come from either side. Atrial fibrillation is a left-sided rhythm problem, specifically from the top left part of the heart, the left atria. The most dangerous rhythm problem comes from the left ventricle, the bottom left part of the heart. Those are the ones that are life-threatening. But you can have rhythm disturbances on the right side of the heart. The difference is the access to it and the sort of the risk profile. A right-sided procedure usually carries less risk because it's a vein approach. Vein approach usually negates the possibility of heart attack or stroke. A left-sided approach, where you have to cross over to the left side, enters the high-pressure system of the heart, So it, like a cardiac catheterization, carries a very small risk of heart attack or stroke.
Pulsed field ablation. What's better about it? Is it easier? Is it more thorough? Is it quicker? What is it and how is it better?
So the theory behind pulsed field ablation is that it is a more targeted and effective ablation that is specifically directed at the cardiac cells, sort of a direct current into the cell that essentially explodes the cell that we're targeted at. It's called electroporation.
Okay, so as opposed to the catheter, your piece of linguine that's coming all the way in, and it's more specific than that?
Well, it's delivered from the same type of catheter. It's just how the energy is delivered. So in the past, we've tried cold, which is called cryoablation, where you delivered cryo technology to freeze the vein.
Yeah, you're freeze drying it, essentially.
The most common and effective over the recent years has been radio frequency, which is basically heat, which does a good job. However, there were small, minor complications that could occur with the nerves around the heart and the esophagus, the food pipe around the heart. What pulsed field ablation has done is eliminated the complications of radio frequency because they are so targeted that it leaves alone the esophageal tissue or the nerve tissue so that those complications reportedly don't occur. You can perform ablation much like a radiation therapy for cancer. So you can map out the heart. The mapping takes an extensive amount of time, but then the patient can come to the table, set up correctly, and you can deliver radiation pulses to the exact spot where you want to ablate.
Without a catheter?
Without a catheter.
The mapping is done without a catheter. Everything is done externally.
Correct. Yep. But I don't see that really taking hold. We've known that for a while. I think Washington University in St. Louis has been doing it. I haven't seen that take hold yet. This goes away from electrophysiology, which is we do, and we put in the hands of radiation technologists. So.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't see that happening. What I do see, from our standpoint, I mean, maybe futuristically, I think robotics is going to grow, especially for the ventricle. So where you'd rather move robotically in a ventricle to help you maneuver for ablations, and then pulse field in the ventricle, which hasn't been approved just yet, but I think that's going to be the next effective step that we take. So patients with life-threatening heart rhythm problems in the ventricle, we can protect them with a defibrillator, but if the defibrillator becomes active, we want to do something to prevent that. And again, I feel that ablations are going to do better than drugs. And the pulse field, which is a more effective ablation, that might be the next thing that we're going to see a lot of.
In some of my reading, researchers talk about how there haven't been any big advances in treating or AFib in 30 years. And yet, sounds to me like ablation has been advancing, and that's a treatment.
Yes. That what we've learned over the years is that the treatment of AFib is better the earlier you do it. So this is much different than the concept of 10, 15 years ago where you would try observation, medication, wait to see how it goes, and then the ablation was sort of thought of toward the end of the options. Now, the current thinking is to get to the ablation the first sign of AFib, which makes sense with all of medicine. You know, nobody ever found a lump and said, let's wait and see what happens to it, right? You want to be proactive. So as soon as AFib is diagnosed, the best treatment with the best long-term outcomes is to go for the ablation. That's the number one therapy now.
Now, in terms of the medications, the pharmaceuticals, have there been advances in that, or are those basically to treat the symptoms and not handling the cause?
You know, medications are sometimes needed, but not a lot of advances with antiarrhythmic therapy. The most effective drug remains a drug called amiodarone, which is an excellent drug for atrial fibrillation, however, carries a side effect profile longer than my arm. Mm. So we have to take that in consideration. Most of us are using drug therapy only to bookend the ablation, you know, to let you heal from the ablation. And then the goal of what we try to do with AFib is actually get you off medication. So the current studies, you know, for AFib is if you treat it with ablation, and you're aggressive, you have a chance, you know, to stop medications, which in this country, I think would be a good thing.
Touch-ups on ablations. I mean, do these electrical impulses find another way to disrupt things after you've dried out the cells in one area?
Yes. So, you know, number one, atrial fibrillation is your diagnosis. We do not cure atrial fibrillation. And two, the ablation is good. It is better than medications. However, still, it's not 100% successful. As we move towards success rates, if you're the right type of patient, in other words, we get you early, your anatomy is good, success rate can be 80% or more. However, you'll need to be monitored, which is part of the strategy as we take care of you. And the touch-up, you know, runs 15, 20% of the time.
In terms of the ways that ablation has progressed and now the pulse field, do we think that maybe that's going to result in less need for further ablations or touch-ups?
That's the current hope. Pulse field ablation came out with the idea that it's going to be a better ablation so that the success rates would be hopefully towards the 90% range. But still, I think it's a rhythm problem that will have to be monitored while we follow you. And there's always a chance that other things may occur, you know, with the fibrillation. It's a kind of a complicated rhythm disturbance because the top part is involved. So you have atrial fibrillation, but akin to that, once you start to work, is atrial flutters, atrial tachycardias, things like that. So, like I said, we'll always be following you.
Yeah, I guess AFib is an umbrella in some ways.
Yes. It's part of what we call the sick sinus syndrome. As we age, the top part of the heart ages, and there are things that we see. And atrial fibrillation is a big part of that. AFib is the most common rhythm problem in the world. You start to see it pretty much after the age 40, and then increases with time, so that by the time we hit 70, 80 years of age, over 20% of us could have it in one form or another. In my opinion, we've seen a little bit more since COVID. I think you're going to find that COVID and AFib have a relationship.
It's people who have had it.
Yeah. AFib is, you know, like I said, very common, can be related to a lot of lifestyle measures, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, age, things, you know, that we can and cannot control. But we're always going to have to take care of it.
How do you see what you're doing in there, doctor, when you're rummaging around with all of this energy?
So imaging has come a long way with ablations, and we are able to create maps, very specific maps, with our catheters. This would be, instead of the ablation catheter, we have mapping catheters, which can give us the electrical anatomy of the atrium. We sometimes blend in a CAT scan into our system so that we know exactly how the patient is built, and then we create the electrical map so we know exactly where we are.
Is this all done at the time of the procedure?
Yes.
How many catheters are coming in and out?
So typically, you know, for a ablation procedure, there would be one catheter for imaging. So we have an ultrasound catheter that we introduce to let us see the structures of the heart. Then there would be a mapping catheter, and then the ablation catheter. So three catheters usually.
So Star Trek would have an all-in-one someday.
So there's a new pulse field ablation catheter that allows to do mapping and ablation. So that helps with the workflow. So all we really need is a reference catheter that we put in the heart, one imaging catheter, and then the ablation mapping catheter. So still technically, for the most part, most everyone is using three access points with the leg vein and then go up into the heart.
How is AI affecting all of this?
You know, the procedure, you know, a procedure that is not AI performed as of now. There are thoughts in terms of, we do robotic ablations here at DeBora, and there are some programs where we can just introduce the catheter into the heart and pre-program it and let AI do the ablation. That is not taken hold yet, so we're waiting to see. I think what AI is going to help us with is mining medical records, finding patients, treatment profile for all the patients. AFib is still relatively untreated in terms of the patient population.
Why is that?
I think things change, you know, slowly. We're in that transition where a lot of cardiologists didn't treat AFib as aggressively as we do now.
Do you see AI having a role in that?
AI is probably going to have a lot of role, but I don't know exactly how it's going to figure into AFib.
Pacemakers, they've changed over the years. So they're smaller and leadless now, basically any pacemaker you put in?
Not any pacemakers. Again, pacemakers come in varying shapes and sizes, depending upon what you needed to do. But a standard pacemaker can be done without wires, which is leadless. Basically, that again is a procedure done from the vein of the leg to get access to the heart. And the entire unit is in the shape of, I guess, a small bullet that's placed in either the top or the bottom chamber or both chambers to work as a pacemaker. So the big advantage of that is that there's no wires in the heart, there's no surgical scar, much less problems with infection and issues that can occur with the wires. The biggest issue we have with an indwelling, wire is that if an infection gets onto a wire embedded in the material, the recommendation is to take it out, and you have to take out the whole wire. Implanting a traditional pacemaker with wires is a relatively low-risk procedure. However, once the wire's in there, if we have to take it out for any reason, taking them out, the extraction procedure carries a little bit more risk, so we have to, proceed cautiously with that.
The benefits for patients then is that it all seems less complicated to have it smaller without the wire and the infection risk down the road for a wire and all of that, huh?
Correct. Correct. But again, this is just for standard pacing. There are other type of pacing maneuvers that a leadless device does not offer our patients. So if some of our sicker patients need a different type of pacing system, one to actually help the heart work better. A leadless pacemaker is a great pacemaker from just a standard viewpoint. In other words, the job of a pacemaker is to prevent you from going too slow. And these do a good job with this. But again, this is the leadless is the first iteration. It's going to evolve over time, hopefully offer us more opportunities to help our patients.
What's the range of sizes of pacemakers? So the leadless one is the smallest. You said like a bullet size.
Yeah, leadless is like basically a bullet that's placed in the heart. Traditional pacemakers usually run about the size of a half dollar.
So the future of these device implants, pacemakers are not the only kind of thing you're going to stick in the heart to take care of a rhythm problem. So
correct.
What are we using now and where do you see them developing and refining?
A basic pacemaker, again, is to prevent you from going too slow, which is an issue with the heart, especially in conjunction with problems like atrial fibrillation. But the biggest concern in terms of devices is the treatment for the bottom part of the heart.
That's cardiologist Dr. Raffaele Corbisiero. He's been looking at more device developments and fascinating research in the field of cardiology that we'll delve into next month. The podcast will be available here the first Wednesday. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at demanddeborah.org.